Well, it's a a real pleasure to follow Ken. It's the second time, really, in 2 months that I've done something like that, because we were in France together at Montpellier for the European Society of Agronomy meetings. And for those agronomists that are thinking of venturing a little further afield, European Society of Agronomy meetings are an absolute delight to attend, and the food is a hell of a lot better. Okay. I'm going to take a little bit of an approach similar to what Ken did, in the sense that I'm not going to overwhelm you with data, but perhaps talk a little bit more about some of the possibilities from an advice point of view, from someone who's got considerable gray hair and spent many years working in the agronomic area of cropping systems. But I want to begin, of course, with the projections in this particular one, of course, by Edgerton from Monsanto, as to how we're going to achieve these corn yield predictions of 20 tons per hectare by the year 2030. And I'd like to particularly focus, of course, on this lower bar or portion of the bar in each one of these cases, and it particularly points out, and I think disappointingly so, how little of a gain there is actually in yield that's coming about from agronomic effort. And if that's the case, then perhaps why in the hell are we here? So anyway, that's kind of where my starting point is, because it seems that all of the magic is in biotechnology traits, plus, of course, the very valuable contributions from marker-assisted breeding, and of course, the old faithful, reliable conventional breeding. In terms of agronomists, I'd like to think that agronomists essentially study crop and soil management system interactions to improve sustainable production, that's sustainable economically, environmentally, of course, and we have a significant role in training young agronomists to anticipate these future interactions and to be able to co-design, and co-design is used here intentionally, because I think co-design involves agronomists working together with, of course, pest management specialists as well as physiologists and geneticists, because technologies are certainly evolving and climate is evolving. I'd like to point out one helpful book in all of this, and that is a book that was edited by Sadras, who gave a presentation earlier in the C2 session, and by Daniel Calderini. And this is an absolutely treasure of a book, and I would recommend it for those of you that haven't read it yet. And essentially, chapters in that book approach from a physiology perspective, an agronomy perspective, and the linkages with genetics in terms of what Ken already pointed out, which is essentially G by E by M. And today's question then is, as an agronomist, do you approach it any differently if you're doing G by E by M by T? So that's essentially the question that I'd like to suggest. But it comes against a background, and that background is essentially looking at what's happened in terms of our agronomic practices over time when it comes to hybrid selection. And I'm going to pick a tillage experiment that started at Purdue University in 1975. Which was about 23 years before I came to Purdue in 1998. And it was kind of interesting. The agronomists that very nicely planned a beautiful experiment that I was very happy to take over made the decision for approximately a 15, 16-year period to plant just one single hybrid, because their thinking was, well, let's just look at essentially the tillage, and in this case it also had a rotation function, and let's really understand this system well by planting the same hybrid year after year after year. Was it helpful in improving yields? Of course not. Was it relevant at the end of that time? Perhaps, but barely. And so I'd like to suggest that although this kind of an approach has value when you look at mining the data in terms of looking at plant-to-plant variability, because the same genotype was used over a 15-year experiment in the same plots, that approach isn't going to work. And so essentially, we're left with, of course, the obligation as agronomists to essentially to selecting those genotypes that are at or as close as possible to the yield potential in that given soil and climate environment. And so we're constantly changing hybrids, sometimes to the detriment of getting our publications accepted by certain journals. Okay, what's going on in terms of stack traits now? And I've chosen to divide this talk into a counterplay between two opposing forces. The one is a sort of looking at the opportunity side, and the other is looking at the challenge side. And so you'll see a little bit of a back and forth on this, and you have to recognize that it's being done by a Purdue person coming from a football team that's really more used to giving the ball away. Anyway, so here we are. We've got better enabling study of genotype and management response to abiotic stress factors, as perhaps Canada's already dealt in more detail with. And we've got an opportunity, I think, when looking at stack traits to develop superior recommendations and guidance for both trait as well as refuge crops, provided that we have a critical mass of data. And our critical mass of data from public institutions is pretty sparse. And so that, I think, contributes to our problem in terms of being at the leading edge. Because, number one, we don't work on very many hybrid pairs that are relevant to the dominant hybrids that farmers are growing in a particular region, and we don't have enough locations even when we are working with the right genetics. But still, having worked in the public sector most of my life, I believe that there still is a lot of credibility in having an independent data source, especially as seed costs escalate as more traits are incorporated. And I would also say that there is one huge bit of relief that comes through me every time I plant BT corn borer, BT rootworm hybrids, and that is the confidence that these new transgenic traits give me in not losing an experiment over some pest. And so I began, as an example, to work on twin row corn 20 years ago. And at that time, I was dealing with obviously non-transgenic hybrids, and you know, it was sort of likely that I would, you know, lose an experiment now and again to things like corn borer, which I wasn't able to control. Switching now from the opportunity to the challenge side, the challenges in really doing agronomic research with stack traits is that there are isolines available that may vary in more than just a specific trait alone. And so what is the purity is always perhaps a good question to ask. And certainly the isolines that are available today are perhaps closer genetically than to the non-transformed a genotype in the same family than was the case when we first started to do this. You have to factor that in. The hybrids are not just a single gene different. The second challenge is, I think, that the choice of site locations is extremely important, especially when we deal with those traits that give us some defense of yield potential. And by that, I mean essentially the pest resistance that it affords. And third, that choices really need to be made with respect to the pest management systems for hybrids being compared. One of the major questions is, okay, are you going to keep all aspects of the treatment consistent, or are you going to vary them by the genotype that you're actually planting? And so, for instance, you run into the situation about, whether glyphosate is, for instance, for a glyphosate-resistant crop, is the only herbicide you use on both BT glyphosate as well as something that's just Roundup Ready alone. Or do you use an insecticide on both? Something that is rootworm resistant as well as on something that's not rootworm resistant? Or do you do what the conventional farmer practice would be in most cases, except for those farmers with deep pocketbooks who might apply both rootworm insecticide plus a BT rootworm application to their field. And then, of course, we've got all of the weather challenges, and I was just about tempted to buy canoes for my graduate students this past summer. Okay, example one, and I'm going to go through a couple of series of examples here of G by M by T research, and these are drawn by and large from my experiences and those of my colleagues at Purdue University. So here would be an example of hybrid by location year by N trait by trait. So this is the four ways, two Roundup Ready hybrids, they're rootworm resistant to hybrid counterparts, conducted by Jim Cambrato and Bob Nielsen to answer the central question with Monsanto funding, and that is essentially, does the presence of the corn rootworm resistant trait influence optimum N rates, yield, or NUE? And the results for a two-year period, two sites, so that's in other words, four site years, continuous corn program where we would expect to have some rootworm. We also are in an area of Indiana where we also have, of course, a rootworm variant even when in a corn-soybean rotation, but this is continuous corn. These yields are, unfortunately, for those of you with a more familiar with the metric, this is switching back to U.S. units here, but essentially we're doing very well in terms of yields at around the 260, 270 bushels, which is essentially the same thing as about what would that be, something in the neighborhood of 16, 17 tons per hectare, something in that neighborhood. The key thing I wanted to point out is that essentially there is no yield difference at any nitrogen level. But it's also fair to point out that the rootworm rootworm-resistant hybrid did not receive insecticide, whereas the Roundup Ready hybrid did receive force as an insecticide. And so the experiment in some ways is kind of a fair comparison in the sense that farmers would essentially apply the insecticide when they know that they're in an area where rootworms are a significant threat and where the hybrid does not have the resistance. So that's essentially one approach. But of course, this is also a reflective of a situation where the overall root injury sampled at the R1 stage is fairly low. So on a three-point scale, using the Iowa system, the worst that we get is 0.24 out of a scale from 0 to 3. So very low rootworm pressure. Example number two comes from Iowa State University, and essentially from a colleague of mine in the soil fertility area, Tony Mallarino. He gave this talk yesterday, and so I apologize a little bit for some of you that may have heard his talk yesterday, but he essentially does, again, the same approach, which is basically G by E. In this case, the nutrient of question is K by trait. And so he's got a series of four hybrids over a four-year period used at different locations compared to the rootworm resistant hybrid isolines, and these are all DeKalb hybrids. And 27 site years, that's one thing that Iowa researchers do well. They do a lot of locations. This is continuous corn, and four potassium fertilization rates going from 0 to 170 kilograms per hectare. Measurements again, which is essential if you're going to do this kind of research of G by T, you have to, and if the T is rootworm resistance, you have to have some measure then of rootworm damage. And so that's been done here. And plant NPK uptake, grain removal, and grain yield. He picked 10 of the sites in which there was a positive response to K and essentially came up with the story that there is a small improvement in yield. In this case, switching back again to the metric units, it's a very small range here from 10.4 tons, which is about 160 bushels, let's say, going up to 12.2, so it's getting close to 200 bushels. So anyway, a very small yield gain, and interestingly enough, a apparent indication of a lower potassium requirement in the corn rootworm resistant hybrids than was the case in the susceptible hybrids. But note that this is just for the 10 out of 27 sites that had a positive response to potassium. And when he looked at it over all of the 27 site years, there was approximately a 5% gain in corn yield with the corn rootworm resistant trait, a 7% gain in total potassium removal in the grain, about a 4 to 5% advantage in terms of higher nitrogen and phosphorus removal in the grain again. But look at how small these actual differences are. They're pretty minor. Another example is hybrid by management combination by trait. So this is, you might say, a simpler experiment because it's just G by M by T, but management combinations here can be very complex. And in this particular case, we wanted to answer the question at Purdue University about whether the trait selection impacts the interaction of two management variables, including N uptake and N fertilizer, or sorry, plant density and N fertilizer rate. So these are a series of experiments that we've been focused on that interaction now for the last 5 years at Purdue in some of our physiology research. So it's simpler in one sense, in the sense that this particular experiment, we don't have a lot of locations, it's very labor intensive, and we're very much focused on the physiology. And these are some of the PhD students that are involved with this project, and a lot of physiological measurements, including photosynthesis, stalk diameters, kernel numbers, and all of those good things. But essentially, at the end of the day, there were no yield differences at all due to the trait, and so the trait here is essentially a Dow hybrid Microgen 2M749, which is non-rootworm resistant but Roundup ready, in other words glyphosate resistance, compared to 2M750, which has the rootworm resistant trait. I combined the data, and essentially, you know, the pattern is essentially one that we often experience, which is that at zero N rates, yields decline at higher density, and then there's a large number of factors that go on in terms of the timing and the allocation of the nitrogen under a high plant density stress. The fourth example is getting back again to G by E by M by T, and essentially looking at hybrid by site year by density by trait. So this is just a density phenomenon. This particular one, you can tell, judging by the hybrids, was funded by Monsanto. And essentially the question was, does this corn rootworm resistant trait influence the optimum plant density or yield components, as well as some other physiology measurements of interest? And for the sake of time, I'm just going to present a few highlights on yield. So essentially, in the light blue, we've got the rootworm resistant trait, and in the dark blue, I've got the glyphosate resistance without BT corn rootworm protection or yield guard. So essentially, these are the plant populations, in this case done as plants per acre, and we essentially see that these hybrids are essentially the same. The mean separation here is just for the VT3 hybrid, but you can kind of get some sense in terms of overall mean separation. So yields, you know, increased up till about 40,000 plants per acre, but there's really not much in the way of difference in terms of optimum plant density in the rootworm resistant versus the Roundup Ready trait. And this, again, is in an environment where we have a corn-soybean rotation, very little rootworm pressure, as, again, reflected by the very low root injury scores in the sampling at the R1 stage. So one complication from all of this work with traits is, of course, that you really have to document very, very well what is the impact of that trait on that biotic stress. Or in the future, of course, if we get abiotic stress tolerance, you really have to document very well for your given environment just how that stress is being experienced by the representative corn plants that are part of your study. And then this is another a site the same year, and in this particular case, there is a slight yield advantage for the Roundup Ready hybrid compared to the VT3 at one population. And my point, essentially, we're just cherry picking the data here, but essentially you have to trust me, okay? Have you heard that before? No. But essentially, my point essentially on this is that there are examples in which the trait characteristic does result in an increase in yield. There are other situations where it does not result in an increase in yield. And in order to really ferret these responses out, you need to have a large number of sites. But it's not just locations. You need to have a large number of management variables. And I'm suggesting that nitrogen rate as well as plant density variables need to be closely examined whenever we do trait comparisons. So more challenges then. Whenever we have stacked traits now, and by stacked I essentially mean perhaps multiple resistance genes for the same pest, then I think it sort of compounds the complexity of what we might want to look at as agronomists in terms of G by E by M. Measurement intensity to document the extent of crop protection realized by each trait is essential. This research is very expensive, and like Ken asked, should we even do it at all? Ken's answer was perhaps not. And indeed, there is an opportunity cost of sinking our time, and that's perhaps the most valuable thing we have, not just because we get paid high salaries, but more because time on Earth is short. So essentially, there is an opportunity cost, and should we be doing this? And I guess my answer to this is that we shouldn't be doing this unless we are learning something fundamentally new in science that is going to be relevant to our growers and that is going to train our students to be thinking more about the management interactions with new genetics in the future. And then there's also the other factor that's going on, which is that some pests are actually decreasing in number in the Corn Belt simply because of the ubiquitous presence of these resistant genes. And so just a month ago or even less, Hutchison's article in Science essentially documented the fact that there is lower European corn borer numbers even in fields that don't have the corn borer resistant gene, and we're simply picking up a benefit of lower pest pressure. And in fact, this article was kind of interesting because it suggested that the people that are gaining the most from the adoption are actually the farmers that don't use BT corn borer hybrids. And that's fascinating. You ought to read that paper if you haven't already done so. And then the other challenge, of course, with comparing stacked transgenic traits is, as Ken pointed out, and I'm only focusing here on the ones that are in detected in Indiana, most recently water hemp, and Bill Johnson at our university does a really nice job of resistance management, and he was preaching against the exclusive use of glyphosate long before the resistant weeds came about. And essentially, I think that's a similar tack to what agronomists have to do. Agronomists have to be involved with industry and their colleagues there to essentially help to plan for the wise use of all resources, including these genotypes with perhaps traits of high value. Okay, more recent complications to complementary agronomy research, stacked genes for resistance to the same traits, refuge in the bag, and Ken already mentioned that. And I guess one of the concerns I have with refuge in the bag is that now essentially we're going to be asked to do agronomic research with not just one genotype in our plot, but two. And some of you might know that I've got a lot of interest in plant-to-plant variability, and I'm really concerned about maintaining plant-to-plant uniformity at higher densities. And this is going to complicate, I think, the measurement and the recording of plant-to-plant variability, for instance. But perhaps those effects will be minor if, in fact, the genotypes are very similar and if the presence of the biotic pest isn't that high. And then, of course, whenever we pick up seed lots from companies, we need to ensure that the seed treatments that are actually used for these isoline hybrids are exactly the same. And in the future, I can see some problems in terms of availability of seed for these isoline hybrid comparisons, because they won't necessarily have a non-transgenic event necessarily available, or perhaps not with the combination that you want. So finally, in terms of opportunities again, and you'll notice I go back to the opportunity side, I see a lot of excitement about the offensive traits in terms of yield enhancing that are promised by industry, especially on nitrogen and water use efficiency, or perhaps other aspects of abiotic stress tolerance that Ken talked about. I think it's essential that agronomists really spend a lot of time with their industry and universities, other university sciences, to advance the fundamental science of what, when, why, and how. And I think we need to use these future transgenic events to play a leading role in integrated technology adoption. And our focus, folks, has to be on sustainability gains of higher yielding crops, as well as focusing on students of tomorrow. Three cautions at the very end. Never overlook G by M interactions, and this was illustrated by a poster yesterday in the C2 session, where essentially green is low and tan is high, and essentially the response to plant density and nitrogen as far as yield is concerned is, in this particular example, going from the bottom to the very top corner here, is exactly opposite that of the NUE response, where you're going from low to high, and having the highest NUE in examples where you have the highest plant density but the lowest nitrogen rate. So my point is essentially that if anyone claims that they have something that is going to give you a gain in terms of nitrogen use efficiency, then as an agronomist you right away think not only the environment but the interaction of management factors for that genotype, because it might be a completely different story in another management interaction system. Second is a caution to try to enhance, where possible, industry-university collaborations, and one of those that we've had this past summer is on leaf test sampling at the R1 stage for metabolite and transgene expression when you have different management interactions. I think those make wise and intelligent use of research studies beyond the university domain, you might say. But we need to make the best use possible of resources. And as Ken so wisely pointed out, don't ignore the roots. And so we've had a lot of interest in focusing on some of the fractal dimensions of roots growing in these different systems with different traits. Finally, I'd like to thank some of the sponsors of the research that I've been able to initiate. And I thank you all for your attention today.
Just a couple of minutes if anyone has questions for Dr. Venn, and then we'll open it back up for questions for all of our three presenters this morning. So any questions for Dr. Venn?
That first slide, they said I inherited the tillage trial.
Right.
And we chose 15 years in the same hybrid, and we know why we chose a single hybrid. In retrospect, when you took it over and you decided to change the hybrids, do you now regret the choice of not maintaining that one other hybrid in a split plot kind of fashion? Because what we're after is indeed is convergence of the technology and the genetics with a management input. And they're always going to be confounded, and we can't figure out, if we go back to that initial slide, if we're actually going to make a contribution, or if it's always going to be blamed on the genetics. If you had included that original hybrid, you could have seen if there was a convergence or not.
Right. No, I appreciate the comment. So essentially the comment was perhaps it would have been wiser to learn more about genetic versus agronomic gains over time if we had continued to use that old hybrid as a split and then compare it against perhaps the elite hybrids. Well, first of all, I have to confess that, number one, it's a very arduous process to maintain seed production when the company is no longer interested. And so, and the other thing is, I'm always opportunistic, and so when Pioneer offers free seed, I'd rather just plant that. And then third, whenever we focus on plots, you have to think in terms of basically, is a plot of a sufficient size to allow a split without compromising something else? And so in our case, we decided to split the plots when it came to soybean variety evaluation. We continued on these particular plots to use Williams 82 or 3, Sean, help me out. 82, thank you. So we used Williams 82, that's my colleague on soybean extension at Purdue. So anyway, for many, many years, we kept going with Williams 82 compared to a modern cultivar, and that provided some interesting clues over time about how little soybean yield has actually changed, and it's kind of disturbing, unfortunately. Another question?
It makes sense that transgenes didn't really change the essential nature of a hybrid, but I guess a bigger question is, do hybrids that we grow today really differ in any fundamental way? That would make that means that we should anticipate some kind of different management for hybrid A versus hybrid.
Well, Emerson, I think you've been in this business longer than I have, so you could probably answer that question. But it's a good one, of course. It's one that we think about a lot, is have the hybrids essentially changed so that we could anticipate something really different? I mean, of course, hybrids have changed with respect to more erect leaves. They've changed with respect to tolerance to be able to be grown at higher densities, and that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of our agronomic research should incorporate a density factor where possible. The stay green nature, the proportion of nitrogen that's taken up in the post-silking period now compared to hybrids of 30 years ago. I mean, there's a number of things that I believe are essential. Where I worry a lot is essentially that in public institutions, other than for those states that still have good variety testing programs, and there are some that do that, but essentially we're often working in fairly low number of experiments with a fairly low number of genotypes, and I worry some about the opportunity to be relevant in production recommendations when our sample size is as small as it is. Yes?
Tony, this morning you asked an excellent question on the seed division. Mm-hmm. You couldn't answer the question. And I wonder whether you can answer your own question. The question was, what's a farmer in Missouri that's been up 60 bushels per acre? And the reason I ask the question, because USA, what are we doing as agronomists? Now, obviously, he's an agronomist. He works with the same genotype, and he can, increase yield from 60 to 160 bushels per acre. So I think there's something to be learned there.
Right.
What is it?
Yeah, obviously, you missed the first talk.
Tom Sinclair, of course, expressed considerable doubt on the 160 bushel soybean actually being achieved, and his kind of humorous take on that was UFO, so unconfirmed. What was it again?
What's your take?
My take is that. That if you really want to be a true agronomist, you have to be all about, number one, having a very fundamental understanding of the crop that you're working with, which is one of the reasons why I think that it is stupid for universities to hire extension specialists that do corn, soybeans, and wheat. and perhaps alfalfa thrown in there too. We don't, sorry, Bill. But in your case, Bill, they'll need to replace you with three. So, but anyway, so we need focus because we need to understand the fundamentals of the crop that we're working with. And then secondly, I think that we always have to be thinking about tweaking micronutrients, planting dates, seeding rates, where possible, using the best advances in terms of planting systems. In some ways, we are always focused on adjusting to try to work where possible as close to the yield potential that Ken Kassman talked about. And you've got a response on this,
yeah,
too.
I think this will be a good opportunity for those of you that maybe just came in. Our last speaker is not going to be here today, and we have about 30 minutes here. And this will be a good segue into opening it up into discussion for any or questions for any of our three speakers. And Dr. Kassman, actually.
I wanted to further elaborate on the response to that. That is this, that these yield contests we have to be very careful about, because farmers that win them have tremendous potential for economic gain when they win them. They are offered tractors, combines, all inputs, all seed, and an incredible ability to travel the world and tell the world about how they're getting these high yields. I can only tell you in my personal experience with Francis Childs, where a number of us, John Lindquist is in the room, anybody else was on the team, we actually went to Francis Childs fields, put out plots, made measurements, put a weather station, did the same agronomic practices that Francis was using on our plots in Nebraska. At the same time, his yields were winning the contest and being posted on a seed company's website, won't say which one, at one time, up to 500 bushels, I think, or something. 447,
no,
500 at one time.
Yeah.
With the same people saying the same thing. Our yields measured on his plots were 280. We published that in Field Crop Research. We got the same yields on our plots. We can simulate those yields with a robust model. So I think let's be careful in separating science from non-science in general on this. Yeah.
But as a follow-up on that,
hey, we can share the mic around.
Yeah, please.
How do we handle the fact that in the popular press, and we won't mention any names, this gets a lot of mileage, and you can be a naysayer the whole time, but you're not going to get as much traction.
Well, I think this is a key point. I would suggest, so what we've done is offered to the National Corn Growers Association that we would simulate as a quality control on their winters. We would, if they would provide us with the planting date and the management used, the hybrid, we would simulate yields, and we have enough good models to get close enough to know if it's 15 or 20% above simulated yield is probably a UFO. We have soybean models that could do that. I think all of us should be engaged with industry and challenging these, because the commodity groups love these things and are promoting them heavily. So the National Corn Growers, the Soybean Board are promoting, because to them it means there's this unlimited potential, and any indication of food versus fuel competition is something not to worry about at all. Right? Yes. Yeah, and promotion. And so we have a responsibility to be very consistent on this, and ask them if I think every one of us as an extension or scientist should say, if you really want to promote these things, let's have a quality control check that's based on the biophysics of the system as Tom Sinclair has described it.
But what about the economics? You've not addressed the economics at all in the cost of that production.
I think maybe, I don't know whether you want to bring in other speakers here, but my point is a little bit that although I accept that it is important to bring very good science, it's also important for agronomists to and physiologists to, where possible, be engaged with those farmers who are very, very close to the yield potential. And so it may not be 160, maybe it's 115. That is a huge difference, but there is something about trying to understand why that system works in that environment, and it's not necessarily something that can be duplicated to another soil without chicken manure and without, you know, nighttime irrigation and all of those factors. But we have to understand the fundamentals of crop response better, and we have to do so working with the best adapted genotypes, you know, regardless of their stack trait combinations. And especially we have to be working with those genotypes that offer an opportunity to utilize our diminishing resources better.
Any other? Just a record.
Difficulties.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it. A lot of good symposium ideas for next year. Any other questions for our presenters?
So why aren't farmers demanding more information about the new genetics? Wait 3 years to try the new stuff, right?
The tagline always is, on a seed sales guide, the last word is always, it's new. And that is equated always to better. And a lot of times we have no data to back that up.
Who's like to start here?
I think there is one area of real potential optimism. And that is that if the growers themselves form a data co-op, let's just freewheel here. If every maize grower in a region of 5 or 6 counties that had similar environment were willing to share data in a way that it couldn't be attributed back to them specifically, but goes into a data pool on their yield, their nitrogen amounts, their seeding rate, their variety or hybrid, their tillage method, their date of sowing, date of harvest, etc. You'd be surprised. You can actually do statistics on those data and test things. Like, is one hybrid getting a better yield at a lower end rate? Are certain hybrids responding to earlier planting than others? And so I think ultimately the answer to this question lies, the power is in the hands of the producers, but they have been reluctant to share data like those for fear that it can be attributed back to them on a personal basis. And so I think this is a very fruitful area. You can actually run whole experiments, things that you could that would take you 20 or 30 site years of data to ask in a field experiment format.
But I guess
who does that? Young man back there had a postcard against
right.
The priest super scene.
We had a system like that in Ontario from about 2003 to 2006, and it was all online and easy to use, and you couldn't convince the farmers to use it. And location, you know, track back then wasn't the problem, it was just an effort. And they're just not at the point where they're willing to put it.
But crop consultants can use it, and seed dealers can use it. So
yeah, and the seed dealers are the ones that ended up shutting us down.
Because
they can't all be out there.
How do they do it? They can just complain?
No, they wouldn't supply the data. So the farmers wouldn't supply the data. They supplied the data in the beginning, but then they got tired of the system because it wasn't promoting their stuff as best as they wanted. It was easier for them to do it.
But I would agree, though, that with Ken on one point, and that is that it's very well possible that the agronomists of the future will not be working on research station property, but will be working regionally, trying to use all of the precision agriculture tools that we have with replicated strip trials, and there's some recent papers out there, and Patricio has just published on that in Field Crops Research. So I think that there could be a sort of a changing role, but I don't think that that's going to supplant the need for physiology guided agronomy in more detailed trials. But I do think there is a bigger and bigger place opening up for agronomists to work with on-farm producer operations in these multiple environments with the kinds of data gathering that Ken is talking about. But it's not simple. And you have to sell it, and you have to support it somehow. And the university is just going to look at this new faculty member. How many NSF dollars are they going to bring in?
Yes, sir.
I want to ask Ken, much as we've preached about herbicide resistance and weeds, your comment about eventual nutrient stratification in no-till systems, as well as the need in some of your soils for subsoiling enhance that root environment. How soon are we looking at hitting that wall?
So the question is, our management is driving systems to stratification of nutrients for a lot of good reasons. No-till, And just the fact that crops are so darn productive now that when you recycle anything, it's back to the surface. And in most soils, many of the nutrients we work with aren't mobile. They stay there. So anticipating that over the long term, it does seem to me that understanding if there are gains to be made by better matching root system density to the distribution of available nutrients is something to worry about. I know that Mallorino in Iowa is seeing temporary potassium deficiencies on maize when there are dry periods in no-till systems. Okay, he doesn't really see, I don't think very often, a yield response at the end of the year. But he does see deficiency clear, and this is by testing the leaves, and so you identify the system as potassium. And it's because in many of these fields, the potassium has been stratified, and when you do get a dry period, the plant's well watered, the root system's down deep, but the roots are inactive in the top zone where the nutrient, where the potassium is, and it expresses itself as temporary potassium deficiency. It seems to me that's like we were back in cotton in California 30, 20 years ago, where we were starting to see the onset of potassium significant, and in the south, actually, onset of significant potassium deficiencies, and we should be thinking about that. Yes, Tom?
I just want to go back to that, these yield complex. I mean, you know, people have overthinking a lot. Some grower wants to participate in that. They say they have to breed a little bit more to do the harvest.
Well, they do that.
Yeah, they still pump it.
Yeah, I've participated in the Kentucky State Wheat Yield Contest, and I can tell you all the ways to cheat.
Yeah, they put lead in the tires. They put lead in the tires that are combined. See, they'll have two identical drives. One has lead, and there's ways to cheat.
Well, you do that, or before you harvest the plot, you shove the combine into it and have the separator completely full. And on a 3-acre plot, you can add a few bushels per acre by doing that. I mean, there are all, every way you can think of. Measuring with the tape. Shouldn't be telling Chad all, or Chad's aware of all. So, yes, sir.
I expect. Yeah, I'm a geneticist as well as a physiologist, a geneticist as well as a agronomist. And the podium here was a little bit strong. I bet the other side. But I think we need to keep in mind that whatever we come up with in terms of physiology, at least, it can only be implemented if the crop discovers a new trait. It can only be implemented, for example, really effectively if markers linked to the genes controlling that trait can do the other. I sense here that the only good geneticist breeder is either a dead one, or a retired one, Tom is shaking his head, or one that's doomed to work with the grim world of what Ken calls Red Queen breeding.
Well, and to follow up on that, I was asked Dr. Sinclair, you talked about the theoretical maximums and versus the actual achieved yield. And I think you made pretty clear your point that the theoretical maximums, there may not be much, or not much opportunity to increase that, but as far as increasing our achieved yield or getting closer to that with what we actually realize out in the field. Do you have any comments as far as the potential there as bringing the realized yield closer to the theoretical maximum?
Well, that's a challenge because you have to remember that this theoretical yield is what you can expect when you take it to farmers. They just can't get it. They can't afford to do that. And historically, yields on the average region are usually no more than about 80-75%. So the potential yield is really not your goal. It's how close are we to that 75% and 80%. And if I apply 75% and 80%, we're getting pretty close. There isn't much more we've got, I think.
A lot of areas that are tickling death.
Yeah.
And but they're being promised. Sorry, Dr. Speck. They're being promised that. There's this other bump, and unless we really change some fundamental basics, like harvest index would be the easiest one, and maybe the more difficult one, where you have to, before you make that next bump. And so, one of the reasons we started this symposium was indeed the foundation, why economics here, is that foundation is there. I was trained, by the way. That foundation is part of the basis from which we should work and look backwards. And if we can change some of the basic physiology, some of the basic engines, then we can go to the next, and then we have room for agronomists to work.
I have absolutely no question here about physical limit. I've said that for almost my entire career. What I'm talking about is the steepness of the response curve, and I'm talking about this is the case. Now, Tom doesn't agree there's any genetic variation to that, but I believe there is, in which you're going to benefit by having reaching that plateau with a smaller amount of research. So, and I say this is something both environmentalists and agronomists can work on. We'll never change the gap.
Probably have time for one more question.
No, it's not a question. A comment on the last discussion here. I fundamentally disagree with you. I believe that we have, there's a lot of room for improvement. Actually, we don't. We just keep doing what we have been doing for the last 80 years. And we will get there. The room is there. You can show it. It is on both sides, actually. On the soil sides, what has changed in the last 80 years is the ability to maintain photosynthetic rate during the grain filling period and during periods of stress at a little bit higher level. And there's a lot of room to go there. On the sink size, virus index has not increased over that period, but in the last 5 to 10 years, we see a shift here. And there's no theoretical reason why that shift should not occur. And so I can see yields of corn improving by 100 bushels from a theoretical point of view. I'm not talking about whether it's going to happen or not. I'm talking about we don't have to make change fundamental processes. We can continue to increase. It's going to keep being more difficult every time, and it has been. We have this straight line, which is actually maybe straight because you know you get this increased resources putting into it. During that time period, and I guess it will be more and more difficult, but the potential is there.
With that, let's wrap up and thank all our